Namaste. When I was 13, my sister got married, and she and her husband decided to do this really cool honeymoon adventure of 11 days in the remote wilderness in the National Boundary Waters Canoe Area. And it sounded so good that my parents and his parents and my aunt and uncle and my younger brother and I decided to join them. And so we did this remote trip the whole time. We only saw two other people the whole time. It's really quite wondrous. But about the fourth day of that trip, it started to rain. And it didn't stop for four solid days. And back then, canvas tents, have you ever used canvas tents? The tents were soaked, the sleeping bags were soaked, we were cooking with wood, the wood was soaked. I remember being in the bow of the canoe because we had to keep moving and a wave, hitting me and it feeling warm for a moment and of course freezing afterward. And I was about as miserable as I'd ever been in my 13 years on the planet. And at one point when we were trying to get a fire started and it wasn't happening, I said to my father, if I had an anvil, I would tie it around my neck and I would throw it in that lake. And just a little bit of backstory before I tell you what my father said. I knew that he had been in World War II. I remember being like 5 or 6 and looking through this book that I realized later was from his regiment and seeing this ruined church with someone talking on a headset. And he just walked by and said, "Oh, that was me." They made me pose for that shot. And I found out later that he had been wounded twice, missing in action. So he gave me a look I had never seen before, a very kind of impassive, steely look in his eyes. And he said, very quietly, he said, "No one's shooting at us." In a moment, I woke up out of my 13-year-old narcissistic brain and realized that someone else had some other experiences other than me. It was a kind of a dramatic wake-up call for me. That's a little bit about what I'd like to talk about tonight is this process of waking up. Of waking up out of our small world into something larger than who we think we are. Something gets in the way of being present. Have you noticed today? Anything arisen for you that's gotten in the way of equanimous, open-hearted, sustained, non-judging awareness? Has anyone struggled today? And at the same time, has anyone here noticed any moments of stillness, any moments of calm, any surprising moments of presence? I'd like to talk a little bit tonight about practice. It's really kind of a curious word, How's your practice? I'm gonna go do my practice. What is it that we're practicing, really? There's something about practice. I feel like I'm always kind of doomed when I practice. If you practice with an intention to have an unsustained experience of the present moment, of course you notice how your mind is all over the place. If you practice with an intention to open your heart to yourself and to all beings, naturally, you become aware of everywhere you are tight or judgmental or selfish or narcissistic. And yet we practice. If you are a masterful piano player, no matter how good you get, you practice scales. You practice the fundamentals. If you're a professional baseball player, you spend most of your time practicing. Practicing your swing, perfecting your technique. And if you want to sustain a wakeful heart and mind, you practice mindfulness. It's foundational as to how you can live your life with a greater sense of non-judging awareness. So when I think of practice, how many times today did you start over again? How many times did you call yourself back to come back to your anchor, to experience the intimacy of here and now, to re-relax again and again and again? Something magical happens in this process. I was sharing with one of the groups this earlier today how after I was just starting to teach meditation, and someone raised their hand and they said, "I'm totally confused. Am I supposed to concentrate or relax or let go or be kind?" And I thought about it for a few moments, and finally I got the answer, and I said, yes. These simple instructions to relax and to pay attention, they get very nuanced, and yet, in essence, they're very, very simple. So tonight, I'd like to talk a little bit about practice, about how all the various forms of what we're practicing are all about accessing and recognizing what's happening in the now, in this moment, and how to be in this moment, especially when you encounter difficulties and challenges. I'd like to talk a little bit about how present moment non-judgmental awareness has a way of slipping into pushing something away or trying to hold on to something, and how this present moment non-judgmental awareness slips into states where you have too much energy. Your mind is like a caffeinated rooster. Or it'll slide to the other extreme where most of your attention is just trying to control your drooling. And I'd like to talk about how this present moment non-judging awareness gets frozen, particularly frozen in doubt or in ruthless self-criticism. So I'll be offering a classic talk on the hindrances, on the challenges that naturally arise in our practice. And chances are you've heard a variation of this talk before. And each day we'll be ending with a Dharma talk. They're very long days. And just as during the day we're practicing embodied awareness, and I invite you tonight and all of the talks to listen with your body. As one teacher suggested, the Dharma talks, it's kind of like a shower. Just let it kind of flow over and see what gets absorbed. So I'll talk about these states that get in the way of being here in the now, to talk a little bit about the practice of rain, recognizing, allowing, investigating, this practice of non-identification. And when you're visited by these energies, by these five energies, how you can begin to see deeply into the patterns, your patterns of resistance, and how you can sense who you are beyond those patterns. And so it's all about the now. There's a story, kind of a classic teaching story of a Dharma debate between a Korean master and a Tibetan master. And they came into the room with their different colored robes, getting ready to really debate the Dharma. There were their translators. And as the story goes, the Korean, and sort of their fierce inquiry approach, picked up an orange and said, "What is this?" There was a long pause. The Tibetan master spoke with his translator a little bit back and forth. And quite impatiently, the Korean master again said a little more fiercely, "What is this?" A little more talking back and forth between the master and his interpreter. And finally, the interpreter said, Rinpoche says, what is his problem? Don't they have oranges where they come from? But that question is very powerful. What is this? What is this moment? Have you noticed how your moment keeps changing? When you ask, what's happening right now? It's like you're putting your toes into a river that is just in constant motion. I'm always struck by that insight when I begin to really pause and slow down and pay attention, that my moment is always turning into something else. So this question, with many variations, which I'll share about in a little bit, of what is this? What is this moment, this embodied moment? What is this experience right now? This is one of the wings of practice. And when you take that inquiry, when you live and breathe into that question, it leads to wisdom. Wisdom is seeing clearly. It's the distinction between your story or your preferences or your sense of how you want the moment to be to what it actually is. And Tara, in instructions this morning, which may feel like it was 3 days ago, she mentioned these two questions. The first question is the variation of what is this? What is actually happening right now? The second question has different variations. And the question that she offered was to reflect on the attitude in your mind. How are you holding your experience? These two wings of the practice, what is this? Flower into wisdom, the recognition of what is true, what is here. The second question, with all its variations of, can you be with this? Can you allow this to be? What is the attitude in the mind? They begin to open up the flowering of compassion, your capacity to allow, to be, to hold what is here and to allow it to change. So perhaps we can take just a few moments to reflect on this first question in particular. If you like, you can close your eyes. And when you allow your awareness to open into this quality of now, this quality of presence, what is this? Can you name what is here? You may notice as you open to the intimacy of here and now that there is this realm of the body with this fluctuation of feeling, sensations. There is a quality of perception of feeling. You may notice the formation of thoughts or commentary that arise out of your perception of what is here. And you may notice as well this quality of awareness. The body, feelings, perception, formation of thoughts, and this vast ocean of awareness. You might, in your own time, let your eyes open, or if you prefer, you might like to let your eyes remain closed. I'd like to think of the word mindfulness as non-judging awareness. And that is our practice, to be intimately aware and to sense if we can hold it with a quality of non-judging awareness. And there are moments where there is a deep sense of satisfaction with what is here, a quality of allowing, a quality of abiding with what is. And other times, our moment is imbued with some sense of dissatisfaction, some sense of unease, some sense of stress. And our practice, again, is to relax and to pay attention, to relax back into the here and now, to be aware as you breathe when the breath is long, to let it be long. When the breath is short, to notice when the breath is short, to be aware of the sounds just as they are. In our practice, there is a noticing faculty. And I find there are certain questions that help to cultivate this sense of noticing, to facilitate this quality of wisdom, this clear seeing, to name and recognize what is true in here. What is this? What is my experience right now? What am I feeling right now? What am I aware of right now? What is predominant right now? What is arising right now? What is falling away right now? This practice is the quality of remembering. This breath-based practice, Anapanasati, the word sati, is a quality of remembering. Remembering present moment awareness. And there are questions that help to open your capacity to be with, to allow. Some of them are, can I be with this? Can I let this be? A question that can be helpful, particularly when you're in pain, can I bear this? Can I bear this right now? One of my personal favorite inquiries, particularly when I'm with a challenging moment, when I can recognize it and name it, when I can let it know that I see it, to ask, how does this want me to be with it right now? How does this restlessness want me to be with it right now? What does this sadness need right now? And those questions help to prime my capacity to open and embrace and befriend what's here. So we speak often of this acronym of RAIN, and it's such a fundamental part of practice and can be so helpful. The acronym of RAIN, the R, is your capacity to recognize or realize what's here, to name it, to see it, to let it know you see it. The A of this acronym is to allow or to accept, to ask, can I be with this? Can I allow this? And it's very important to really pause on that question. Because inevitably, for some of us, there is a certain drive or expectation that we should be able to be with anything. And sometimes we can't. Sometimes what we encounter that's undigested in our lives, it may feel like it's too much, in which case it can be quite skillful to let it know you see it and let it know another time when the conditions are maybe more favorable, you can be with it, and to shift your attention, to shift back to your anchor, or if it's a very strong experience, maybe to stand or to walk or have a cup of tea. But if you do have a sense that you can allow it, that you can accept it, you can be with it, it becomes an invitation to open to the I of this equation, to be intimate with it, to investigate with a quality of curiosity, to move into a deeper experience of what is happening, and to continue to inquire if you can allow it. The end of this equation is many ways, sort of many ways sort of the end of the formula. If you can recognize, if you can allow it, if you can be intimate with it, oftentimes there will be a shift in how you're holding it, a shift in your identification. And it can result in a sense of non-identification, of non-grasping. Something that initially may have felt so personal now has more space around it. You're not as identified. Someone I know well told me recently of a time when he used this practice quite successfully and somewhat surprising for him. He had a huge amount of responsibility. He worked for a large organization as the COO, and the CEO was an entrepreneur, tons of ideas. So he was always having a new idea he was supposed to implement. And part of his job was to make it happen, but also to protect the entire organization, which got very frustrated with having to change their systems every 3 days. He had been married with 3 children, had gone through a difficult divorce, had remarried, and had an unexpected child on the way. So a huge amount of stress in his life. He realized that he was just sinking in anxiety. And someone in his 12-step program mentioned meditation to him as a way that might be helpful. So he took a deep dive and he learned this acronym, learned these techniques. And he told me about a time when he was able to apply it. He was very dedicated in his work. He really needed the job. He needed the income to support really 2 households. So he put up with a lot. And his boss was constantly wanting him to take on more. And it was always a challenge to try to say yes. At one point, it was on a Friday at the end of a long week. He was exhausted. At the end of the day, he got a text from his boss saying, "I have a new idea. And I want to talk about it with you tonight after dinner. Meet me at this restaurant." And it was too much. He just couldn't take it. And he sat down and he wrote an email that expressed every resentment that he had in his entire life in relationship to his job, his boss, and life in general. He copied the board members and he copied members of the executive team. Felt really good to get it out. And he was just about to hit send, and suddenly something said, "Wait a minute." And he thought back to that acronym. He thought, okay, R. Realize, okay, what's happening? What is this right now? Overwhelmed, angry. And as he sat and he began to identify more, it was not just angry, it was a sense of helplessness, a sense of feeling hopeless. A sense of feeling just crushed. He thought, well, what's next? Can I allow it? So, well, let me try. Let me just see if I can actually just sit in this stew of overwhelming emotions. And so he found he could be with it a little bit. And he thought, okay, well, what's next? Oh, the I, to be intimate and to investigate. And he knew that investigation was an investigation into the felt sense of the body. So he began to explore, where do I feel this? And he could feel the tightness in his throat and the acid. He told me the acid in his mouth and the constriction all through his body. So as he just named that and sensed it and breathed into it, he began to contact his fear, this deep fear of losing his job, and yet also this frustration at not being able to speak up for what he needed. And it all began to sort of shift and churn a little bit. He didn't have a huge breakthrough, but it began to shift. And as he described it, he said it was like a storm started to kind of move through. And he realized that the more he named what he hated about his boss and his job, the more he had to acknowledge that there are parts of it that he liked. He liked the intensity. He liked being in the trenches. And he realized that he would miss this job. And then he thought, what am I doing? And he very, very carefully deleted the email. He sent a text to his wife saying, I'm really sorry, but I'm called to this meeting. And he was kind of surprised that his wife was so accommodating. So he went to the meeting. It was a surprise party for him. That's the magic of the practice. When we can recognize and we can sense, if like, can I be with this? When we can actively investigate, it's the difference between setting up a repeating pattern and opening up new possibilities. Part of the magic of what went into this is precisely what we're practicing. We're pausing before we hit the send key. This is all about stimulus response. For him, it was the stimulus of that text. For us, in any given moment, it's the stimulus of an undigested memory. It's the stimulus of some deep-seated fear that begins to come to the surface. At times, it's noticing when your mind has drifted off into some fantastical future that has nothing to do with reality. It's the stimulus and the response. What is happening right now? Can I be with it? Part of the practice, and part of what I love about this particular practice of transformation, is not only the capacity to pause, but our capacity to actually turn toward what is presenting. When the Buddha had his awakening, part of his recognition was realizing that everyone was looking for happiness in exactly the wrong way. By seeking satisfaction through sense pleasure, by avoiding sense pleasure, when actually it's about pausing and saying yes to our resistance to what's arising. So a little 1 minute Zen pop quiz, if you will, if you can close your eyes. And when you simply open into this inquiry of, what is this right now? What is happening right now? And you might just sense, what is it like to say yes to this moment? To open and allow and consent to this moment just as it is. When we pause and relax, we open to the stream, to this waterfall, this cascade of phenomena flowing through. And as Rumi says, our task is to welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep through your house, emptying of its furniture. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door, laughing, and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. If you like, you can open your eyes or remain with them closed. For me, I love that line. Each has been sent as a guide from beyond. When resistance, when discomfort arises, if we can remember that or open to the possibility that there is an opportunity, that there is a possibility for opening to something bigger than who we are when we can say yes, when it feels safe. So sometimes we can be that welcoming presence You can watch the stream of sensation, the thought, the feeling, the moods, the states passing through, and allow it all. You can say yes to it all. And other times, it's just not easy. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the not so easy part. And it's interesting how, as we develop concentration together, as we begin to calm and soothe, as the saying goes, you will feel better. You will feel your sadness better. You will feel your grief better. You will feel your frustration better, as well as your capacity for kindness and compassion and joy and equanimity. There is a sensitizing. You feel more. You notice more. You begin to recognize the repetitive thoughts, the repetitive beliefs, the habits. I love the analogy, which I share almost every time I give a talk, of imagine a big circle. There's a line through that circle. Above the line is what you're aware of. Below the line is what you're not aware of. And in this practice, and in relationship to your capacity to relax and pay attention, the line moves. You feel more, you notice more, you become more awake, and more inevitably makes its way to the surface. Whatever is undigested in your life comes forward to be seen, to be felt, and to be held in wholeness. Another analogy that I find helpful in meditation sometimes is to imagine that you're a mountain and the weather systems come and go. Sometimes the weather systems are very subtle. Sometimes it's clear skies, and sometimes it is overwhelming. So, about these weather systems, these energy systems that arise and pass through. One is about pushing away, about aversion, all the different flavors of ill will, judgment, blame. The person in front of you is wearing a fragrance shampoo and it's driving you crazy. The room's too cold, too hot. There's too much instruction, not enough instruction. Someone told me of a time, and they were sitting right there. And during the entire retreat, he felt like he was in a space war with his neighbor. And it was just a war of inches. He realized later his neighbor probably wasn't aware of what was going on. But his zabaton would creep over into his space. And so during the break, he'd push it back. And then the zabaton would creep over. And he told me once that he came in for a sit, and the zabaton had creeped over into space. And as he sat down, he described it as a murderous rage. Aversion can just overwhelm us at times. Anger, judgment, ill will. Sometimes it's present moment based. Sometimes it's something from the past or an imagined future. But each one of these weather systems, that when they are fully present, they occlude the sunlight. It is impossible to be present when you are overwhelmed by one of these weather systems. The opposite of aversion has to do with craving, with wanting. Fantasy, planning, getting lost in sense pleasures. It's a form of disassociation. Fantasizing about how great the next meal might be, or how great it'll be to lie down in the sun during walking meditation. Or rearranging your living room. Or you may be aware of the possibility of the Vipassana retreat romance, where as we're all practicing silence and avoiding eye contact, it's entirely possible that you will fall in love, court, marry, have children, and divorce someone in this room without ever speaking to them. It's the natural movement of the mind into that state of desire and wanting. I'm curious, has anyone in this room experienced either of these today? This pushing and pulling is a natural part of the mind. And it can get quite out of hand. I've had some meditations where I sort of wake up lost in fantasy, and I can name the fantasy, but then I'll decide this is just too enjoyable. I think I'll just stay with the fantasy. Maybe you've had that experience. So what do we do when we wake up out of this trance of anger, judgment, blame, or in wanting, fantasy, getting lost in sense pleasure? The magical thing, and what amazes me, is simply the miracle of mindfulness itself. Your capacity to recognize, oftentimes, can help you to disassociate from the state. Just the naming, oh, wanting, fantasy, judgment. That's the first step. If you find it's predominant, then you can explore the practice of rain, to turn your attention from your anchor to the experience itself, to ask if it feels safe to investigate this, and then to begin to explore what that feels like. Aversion, anger, judgment, blame is a felt sense. The body holds that experience. It has an emotional component to it. It has a felt sense component to it. Wanting, fantasy, has a quality of reaching, of grasping. It has another quality to it. And simply to allow, to be intimate with it, sometimes can provide a deeper, intimate recognition of what is there. There may not be a flashy insight, but there can be the capacity to know in a much more intimate way, to be more familiar with that phenomena. And a beautiful thing about familiarity is that it leads to wisdom. Rather than fighting, investigate. So these two energies of pushing away, of grasping, there are two other energies that can be quite powerful as well. And they have to do with low energy and too much energy. Has anyone experienced what we call whiplash meditation today? Chances are it's a kind of a shared phenomena. There are times when I've been on retreat and it could look like sort of a sea of drunken participants with everyone trying to keep it up. This is referred to as sloth and torpor. I'm waiting for a law firm to call themselves that because it's just perfect. And this is the experience of heaviness, of density, of grogginess, of fogginess, of haziness. I remember when I was in school, we had one particular algebra teacher right after lunch. And one day, I was in the back of the room, and he would always talk to one side of the class, then to the other side of the class, in a very kind of rhythmic way. And I noticed how one day in particular, that when he would talk to this side of the class, on that side of the room, everyone's heads would go like this. And then when he talked to this side, the heads would come up and the heads would go down on that side. And I kind of fell into this rhythm. You know, it was after lunch. And then I heard him say, "Mr. Faust, I believe you could see better if you had your eyes open." Sloth and torpor, gone. Replaced, of course, by shame and self-consciousness. But I find it very interesting because when you find yourself lost in sloth and torpor, it can feel like a permanent state. There are times you'll feel like you'll never wake up again. And it's helpful to remember that all of these states, the good news is they are impermanent. They are changing states. In a deeper investigation of the states of sleepiness and grogginess and haziness, it's important to recognize that we are a depleted and overstimulated culture. The chances are very, very good that your sloth and torpor may be purely biological. As you begin to shift from identification with thoughts and stories, and you begin to turn your attention to the body itself. Your body will tell you what it needs. Our practice is kindness. So it's helpful if you find yourself with persistent sleepiness. Honor that. Take a nap. Ensure you get the rest that you really need. There is, of course, another level to sleepiness, which has some form of resistance. There can be a way of just sort of checking out from something uncomfortable or unpleasant. As that line between what you're aware of and what you're not aware of begins to settle, sometimes something can be arising that will feel uncomfortable, and it becomes a strategy for numbing out, for avoiding what's there. So it's helpful to be aware of that, to sort of just ask, is this biological? Or does this have some emotional component? But I personally feel as there's a beautiful yogic aphorism that says, the more dynamic your rest, the more dynamic your activity. Just to be aware that your biology may be speaking to you. On the other hand, sometimes we are in a weather system of restlessness. It can oftentimes have a quality of mental agitation, a quality of worry, a quality of anxiety. Has anyone noticed this, perhaps? Yeah. Agitation, restlessness, again, to investigate it and feel it in the body, to notice it, to name it, sometimes can be very helpful. A friend of mine on a 3-month retreat just struggled with restlessness and really beat himself up. And he had an interview with his teacher, and he was describing his restlessness. And the teacher said, I know that so well. And suddenly it was okay, and it calmed. Oftentimes, when you have the energy and the firepower to investigate restlessness or worry, there's oftentimes an emotional quality underneath it. Again, there's a felt sense quality to it. It's oftentimes tied into some form of worry, some form of anxiety. Oftentimes when I notice this is when I realize that my mind on some particular life issue is as if I'm on a hamster wheel. And I'm just recycling the same thing over and over and over again, but with no resolution. Maybe you've noticed that. A friend of mine was explaining to his young son how a NASCAR race works. And he said to his son, do you see how fast those cars are going? And his son said, yeah, but they're going in a circle. They're not going anywhere. And that's kind of what happens when we get into those states. And as Einstein said, no problem was ever solved in the same consciousness that created it. So when we find ourselves in a rut or in a moment of agitation where we're recycling the same phenomena, somehow we need to shift our consciousness to sense it from another perspective. Sort of recognize it. Allow it. Feel it. Oftentimes it can begin to shift your relationship. If nothing else, you will become more familiar with it, more intimate with it. When these states arise, it can feel like they're not going to change. And one of the most helpful things I've found in my own practice when I feel really caught and really stuck is to remember those 4 words that are guaranteed to make a happy person sad and a sad person happy. This too shall pass. Just remembering that can be very helpful. Also, it's very helpful to remember that in times of expansiveness, when you feel like you've arrived, that too is destined to change. So we've explored this energy of pushing away, of just being caught in aversion, this weather system of wanting, craving, fantasy, planning. The times when your energy is so low, and times when it's just too high, it feels like it's out of control. There's another state, a fifth state, which oftentimes can be quite paralyzing. And it has to do with doubt. And tied to that is the ruthless critic. I'm sure we've all touched into that. One time in particular on retreat, when I was just caught in enormous physical pain, I just felt deeply, I can't do this. It's too much. I found myself caught in the trauma response of fighting it, trying to nuke this pain and make it go away. And then I found myself trying to distract myself from it, just running from it. Other times just being paralyzed by it. And as I shared in my interviews, I explored another way of just to be with it. And I imagined as if I was sitting on a park bench with this pain. Wasn't going to try and fix it. Wasn't going to try and make it go away. But if it was possible just to be with it. Just to sit with it. Along with that, of course, was continued doubt. Why did I ever come here? I should be able to handle this. And over time, it began to shift. Chances are you may have had the thought in your practice of, I can't do this. I'm the only person in this room doing it wrong. And inevitably, this is such an important part of our practice to recognize. When doubt arises, when self-criticism arises, that doubt can be directed internally to doubt yourself, your capacity, a sense you're doing it wrong, you're falling short, or it can be directed externally. The teachers don't know what they're talking about, externalizing the blame, questioning why you came. And doubt is neither good nor bad. Doubt is not something just to push away, because doubt, in fact, has an important part in this practice. Doubt is about the discerning mind. It's about critical thinking. When you pause and you ask yourself, what is my experience right now? And you begin to name what is there, there's a quality of discerning. If you can name, is this sadness? Is this grief? That discerning mind is very, very helpful. The antidote to doubt, I find, one of the antidotes to doubt, is to have an understanding of the practice, to recognize and to remember that you've come here to be more awake, to be more alive, to be more whole, to feel the wholeness of who you are. And the natural byproduct of that practice is everything between you and that, everything between you and feeling free, feeling happy, feeling at peace, will rise to the surface to be seen and to be held. Doubt can have a form of a narrative, of storytelling. It can be interesting to observe. One teacher said that it's helpful to give that voice of doubt or that self-criticism, and give it a name, where you can just say, thank you for sharing, Bob. I'll get back to you later. So there is a mistaken belief in this practice that when you encounter these weather systems, these energies of aversion, of craving, of sloth and torpor, of restlessness, of doubt, that your job is to make them go away. I felt that in my practice for a long time. And it's actually recognizing this is the practice. If we could remember what Rumi said, that all of these are sent as messengers from beyond, if we can welcome them as teachers. The classic teaching story. A woman is meditating in her cave. visited by three demons. And the three demons are racing around the cave, horrible images and sounds. She very calmly gets up and starts building a fire. The demons are annoyed. They're looking for a reaction, so they crank it up a little bit more. Again, very calmly, very quietly, she puts a tea kettle on over the fire. And this enrages the demons. They throw everything they've got at her. Very quietly, she puts out these teacups. Finally, the demons stop, and they say, "What is going on? Were your three deepest wounds, your three worst nightmares? And here you are building a little fire and putting a tea kettle on and putting out these cups." And she says, "Well, you've been here before. You'll be here again. So in the meantime, what kind of tea would you like?" I think that is the essence of our practice here. In the name of waking up the heart, in the name of waking up the mind, you will be visited by demons, by these energies. You can ask yourself, what is this? Can I name this? How intimately can I recognize what is here? And then ask, can I open to this? Can I say yes to this? You may not be able to, and that's okay. It's skillful to say no. But if you can, it becomes an invitation to have tea, to turn your attention to the felt sense experience of that energy, and to continue to inquire, can I allow this? Can I be with this? How does this want me to be with it? Sometimes there may be a cognitive insight. There may be some recognition of how you're holding this that perhaps is no longer needed. Sometimes it's just a sense that that weather system has moved through and you feel a little more clear. You may feel a little more relaxed. Our practice is to wake up. And that could be challenging. I'll share with you yet another story. I opened with a story of sort of waking up at age 13, and I'll tell you another story of waking up. And it was at the end of a month-long retreat, and I was feeling very complete and very full, and I went for my final interview with James. And I was sharing with James how much insight I had had and how clear I felt and how ready I was to go home. And as I was sharing my readiness to go home, I noticed that there was a look of concern in James' face. And I thought, well, that's puzzling. He's normally, you know, so warm and affirming. And as I was going on and talking about how my bags were packed and so forth, he put up his hand and he leaned forward and he said, "You realize the retreat ends the day after tomorrow." That was another moment of waking up. So I'd like to close with a little reflection, a little meditation on a review, sort of the essence of this practice. You might draw your attention into the breath. And you might like to explore this image, this sense of who you are as the mountain, the steady presence. And as the mountain, there is this awareness of everything that moves. Weather systems can arise and pass through. This vortex of aversion, anger, judgment, blame. And patterns arise of wanting, of desire, of fantasy, of planning. weather system of density, of heaviness, of fogginess, sleepiness. The weather systems of restlessness. The patterns of self-doubt, of self-criticism. In all that changes, you might sense who you are as that which is aware. Awareness is not angry. Awareness is not restless. Awareness is not wanting. Awareness is not sleepy. Awareness is not doubting. You are the sky, which is big enough and vast enough through which all this can arise, take form, and pass away. As you reflect on this day of practice, you might just note the quality of now, what has shifted, changed, what you have felt, what has moved through. Reflecting on these words from Dana Falls. It only takes a reminder to breathe, a moment to be still. And just like that, something in me settles, softens, makes space for imperfection. The harsh voice of judgment drops to a whisper, and I remember again that life is not a relay race. That we will all cross the finish line. That waking up to life is what we were born for. As many times as I forget, catch myself charging forward without even knowing where I'm going, that many times I can make the choice to stop, to breathe and be. And walk slowly into the mystery. Namaste. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.